Welcome to Conversations in Cannabis. Today's episode features Adrian Sedlin, CEO at California-based Candescent. This episode was recorded over the phone on June 24th, 2021.
I do want to ask you, most operators that do come into the cannabis space from, you know, say traditional market jobs, either in finance or business development, they always have that interesting moment where they say, you know what, cannabis is going to become my career. What was that impetus for you to say, I need to be in the cannabis market?
Great question. First, thank you for having me. Much gratitude for that. And, you know, it was super clear. My brother-in-law, he'd been a medical cannabis grower going back to the mid 90s. And, you know, so I had already kind of, I always kind of knew what was going on, a little more visibility into it than your traditional suit, if you will. And I had been a power user in my 20s and teens, and I had a really negative experience on cannabis. You know, it now has a name, cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. But anyway, I kind of had to leave category as a consumer for, you know, a long time. And then, you know, when I started to reengage, my brother-in-law called me and he's like, hey, I need to get bigger. And, you know, I had sold my last company, and I then went on like a 5-month super deep dive into the cannabis space, not approaching it as a, so think about it as someone who had left category for a while, was beginning to really try to understand it. And I just absolutely fell in love. And if I were to summarize why I fell in love, is I saw a category that I felt was really broken. And what I mean by broken, it's, I kind of, when you start learning about the endocannabinoid system and everything that cannabis can be, whether it's as a medical product or as an adult use product, it was so clear to me. I was like, so let me get this right. There's this thing called alcohol or traditional pharma, and that's basically a horse and buggy, and we have a car. But yet everything about that car was being marketed in just such a, I'd say, traditional, subprime, overly countercultural way, where it was not, it was going to alienate the traditional, you know, most consumers were, you know, given the heritage of cannabis between it, the just say no days, the war on drugs. And then if it's deeply, cloaked in counterculture, the category was never going to scale in that. And I just said, you know what, it's time for someone, you know, I saw it as just this great opportunity, knowing how to build and scale early stage companies. It's like, we can professionally execute this and make and bring a trust and credibility and consistency to the end product, and then make it much more accessible to people. And I just fell in love because I got super passionate about, hey, you know, it's not a bad idea to be one of the first people to market a car and provide a car when there's industries called horse and buggy, and we know they're going to go the way of the dodo. And I don't mean that literally, but that's the basic idea. Is when I really understood the power of the endocannabinoid system, and that what cannabis, when we get when you project forward 20 years, where the research will be, you know, we're going to be able to. Right now, we're 4-year-olds banging the keyboard, you know, but in 30 years, we're going to be, you know, Beethoven, you know, hammering out symphonies with how we can choreograph and target products, whether on the medical and adult use. And it's just super fun. And it's uplifting, you know, it's something that's good for human beings that I can be proud of. And, you know, most industries have a tough underbelly, you know, it's a bad analogy, but it's the one that hops to my mind. You know, you show me soccer balls or Nike, I'll show you, you know, factories overseas with, you know, 6-year-old stitching up soccer balls. You know, it's just like, and I looked at cannabis, and the only thing that was sort of icky about it was the fact that it was, when I entered the industry, still quasi illegal. And I was like, but the core data suggests that this is the dumbest thing to be illegal on the planet. It should be the exact opposite. And so when I saw that, I was like, I want to get involved. So well, that's,
Well, you brought up an interesting point, the endocannabinoid system and the tradition from looking at cannabis as an ultra counterculture product into a mainstream culture product. When you're looking at the totality of the consumer market, be it medical or be it adult use market, and you're seeing the consumer intelligence rise, say in terpene profile understanding or in alternative cannabinoid understanding, did that surprise you, having come from, again, that ultra counterculture aspect, in seeing that that was broken? Did that surprise you that it happened the way that it did and the speed that it happened?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you're in the space. You and I are in the fishbowl, and we don't necessarily have, we don't know what it's like to be outside the industry anymore. And I'd say, you know, 2 years, you know, when we originally choreographed Candescent as a brand, which is the first brand in our brand house. We now have several others. But when we choreographed that, it was very clear to me THC was not the thing I wanted to bet on over the long term. Because, you know, if potency were the core factor that sold alcohol, you know, Everclear would be the number one selling brand. Ultimately, over time, a space progresses, unfolds. But however, as much as I'd like to say terps are finally seeing their day, I thought it would happen far faster than it is. And I could actually show you most data that there, if anything, potencies in THC potency have become even more important than they were. So, you know, I like to know that the average, you know, the space is growing. So there's going to be people crossing over from, and this is going to be like this for the next 25 years. There's going to be people who become noobs, who then get a little understanding, and they understand sativa, hybrid, indica, and then they're going to understand, oh, actually none of that means anything. And then they're going to get to terps, and you know, and then they'll have the erudition. But I'd still say there's probably more, and we're still super early days in consumer trends. This is a 20, 25 year story. And I think in the crowds you probably run in, terps matter a lot, but I'd say, you know, as a purveyor of multiple brands, I can tell you the store buyers, it's all about potency. And, you know, they don't, you know, and that's the number one buying criteria still. So, I'd say, I haven't been surprised or unsurprised. I just say I've always anticipated that this is a secular trend that's going to last well beyond the time I go to the grave. When I look at sales in our category, you know, we are still 1% of global alcohol sales as an industry. I mean, that's, you know, if in my lifetime we're at 15, 20%, I mean, we're going to be just a massive category. And so I just see it as happening over time, and, you know, and what the trend that will happen is that I bet on is the space is going to become increasingly segmented. You go back to when I was a kid, in my teens and twenties, it's like the criteria of buying was somebody had weed and you could get it. I mean, that was like, if you could get it, you would buy it. If you had a plug, you'd take it. You know, then I'd say, you know, you fast forward to where we are today, or where we were in 2015, I'd say there was a lot more cannabis out there. It was sort of at scale, but no one had a brand. And, I've always felt like the space would come from the generic. Like when I was a kid, there were three or four television channels. Now you have 1,000. And if you want to watch something about home contracting all day long, you can. I think our space will become increasingly segmented, and there's going to be terpene-driven brands that, you know, speak terpene language to terpene folks. And then there's going to be the hardcore THC brands. And then you'll have, you know, the Latin brand like a Dos Equis or a Modelo. You know, you'll have the hip hop brands. You'll have the high-end luxury brands like Candescent. You know, there's going to be a flavor and a lane for every psychographic and demographic out there. And so, you know, that trend is that's the primary trend I see happening faster than the terp trend. It's more, there's a cannabis that now is beginning to hold mirrors up to different segments of the population based on how they see themselves and will reflect back onto a brand.
Well, it's definitely evolved a long way since the dram bottles, of the old dispensary days. Now, a true CPG category of its own.
Remember when they used to chopstick them out? I mean, less than 10 years ago.
I know that. And that's the part. So people outside of California might not understand this, but in the 215 market here in California, that's basically what it was. It was chopsticks, giant mason jars, and you would have dram bottles and you would weigh out everything in front of the patients. And that gave you a little bit of, the ability to kind of say, okay, well, you're my favorite patient, and give you a little bit more. So it has its pros and its cons, but you're right. You know, it has completely changed into a true CPG categorical company where you have true brands establishing themselves and creating SOPs and now moving across the market.
And that's when we came, at Candescent, we saw that was going to happen. But we entered the space back in 2015 when it hadn't crossed over, where it was still the dram market, where we were the first brand that going to most of these stores saying, no, it comes in a jar. You can't open the jar and you can't smell it or tamper with it. And it comes in a box and it, you know, and people and a lot of the dispos, they were looking at us like, no way, no way. And we're like, yes way. And so we bet on brand early, but I just think you're going to see continued traditional CPG dynamics in this space.
Well, and you're one of the few brands, one of the few cultivators, I should emphasize, that actually kind of did away with the old school mentality of, hey, this is our Jack Herrera or this is our Blue Dream. And you actually started going along the lines of effects. What was the impetus behind that drive to go away from the traditional naming aspect and start moving into the effects driven type of marketing to your consumer?
It was a multi-layered decision. I know a little bit about your personal background. You know, a lot of the strain names that we call strains today were invented by dispos that had old stuff on shelf and couldn't move. So anyone who has a sense of history of space and anyone who knows that there isn't really seed stabilization in the genetics and that, one GG4 is not the same of someone else's GG4 because, they got different cuts. And it's just like strains have historically limited meaning. And then if you kind of look at how many of them work, and this was part of like the understanding that I built is I was like, so let me get this right in 2015. There's over 6,000 strain names that I can point to. There's a dizzying matrix of 100 by 100 cannabinoids versus terpenes. And any one of those strains has different amounts of milligrams of each in it. And so the idea of the space was in order to go into a dispensary if you weren't in category for the first time to feel comfortable is now you got to understand what Alaskan Thunderfuck is or Green Crack. And what that means, it's like you literally needed a PhD in weed science to make a purchase. And I'm like, that we just looked at it and said, that's really broken. And there's a great analogy for it, which is it's exactly how tech was in the 80s. When I was a kid, you used to have to know MS-DOS to use a computer. You even had the right code to use a computer at a basic level. And then, Apple commercialized the graphic user interface and realized, technology should work for humans. Humans shouldn't have to work for technologies. So as opposed to miring everyone into, the upper level erudition of what it takes to make an intelligent strain purchase and really understand, linalool versus myrcene versus beta-caryophyllene. Before we ask someone to get their master's, maybe we can just simplify it, build a graphic user interface and just go calm, cruise, create, connect, and charge. How do you want to feel? And that was sort of the genesis of it. And it was interesting because a lot of that was sort of anathema to, a lot of the OGs in the space. And I always said, look, that like they were like, we're taking away their naming rights. I'm like, dude, I am your best friend because we're going to bring people in the category who then will, focus maybe on strains and some of the detail you want to bring them to. But right now, it was a good, and there will always be a marketplace for people who just want to, just like, I'm not making a statement about our Candace in particularly, but you know, Apple may not have the best computers, but they certainly speak to their audience. And they have a core following, and that's why Candace has had a core following. But again, and when it comes to segmentation, as we've evolved as a brand house, we have multiple brands that have, you know, we have a strain driven brand that, you know, is mixed light, whereas Candace is sort of our high end effects driven brand, you know, our mixed light brand for people who want a broader terpene profile at a lower price point and a more, you know, traditional cannabis consumer, they can, that, you know, we have a cult like following in our good brands. And it's why we also have, you know, there's other consumers that want to buy based on their social priorities. And it's why we market and we built a not-for-profit brand called Justice Joints. So, you know, again, we look at branding and products as you build it from the inside out. You actually just don't slap a sticker on something. You design something that solves a problem that people might have. And then if you were right about the problem you identified and the solution you build, well, that's how you build audience and share.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, your brand portfolio. And here in California, you know, we are the world's largest adult use market, but in some regards, we're also the world's most restrictive market and most regulated market. And sometimes opening a brand in California isn't the easiest in the best of times. Being an operator yourself and being somebody that started different brands within the industry, what was the hardest thing for you to kind of get over trying to get this thing off the ground?
Good question. I'd say when I started, you know, there were probably two or three things. First, when we were building our brand, Alma hadn't even passed yet. So I knew I was building a consumer brand in this place. You know, we were out there in 2016, you know, and I refused to use the word patient because, you know, I think patients, you know, if you're going to be a true medical cannabis brand, you're going to look more like Pfizer over time than you do like what I do, which is a rec brand, and they're different things. So I think a lack of a regulatory framework and building into a world where I didn't know what the final, I mean, I remember going back to 2016, flying up to Sacramento and saying, are we going to be able to stack licenses or not? Or are we literally going to only be able to have one? I mean, how's this? Because I was designing our second indoor facility, not knowing whether or not you could have multiple licenses. And so like that designing and building something into that level of uncertainty is maybe not a challenge people would have today, but it was certainly one we faced, you know, not knowing what the packaging requirements were going to be. How do you lay out your processing center when you don't even know what the packaging requirements and rules are going to be? And so I'd say early days, it was uncertainty. I'd say the other thing is, you know, we all know the joke of everyone wants to start a cannabis company and everyone's got a spreadsheet of how they're going to be, you know, throwing off millions of dollars 6 months after their first harvest. You know, my answer was, I would say, let me know how that works out if that's what your spreadsheet says. The reality is that this is a very capital intensive place, an industry, and it requires money to succeed and scale and build high quality products that are compliant. And the cost of capital in this industry is super high. So just finding the money when you're still federally illegal and, you know, Wall Street is still not playing in a major way. I mean, it's different now in 2021. But again, I can't tell you that when I was soliciting people for capital back in 2015, you know, I built out a list of people I would talk to, a lot of people I've known for 20, 25 years, and just the nature of their jobs. They're like, I'm in a regulated industry. I have to pass this by my chief compliance officer if they were in a banking type industry. And they're like, and they got shot down time and time again. So, you know, just bringing money in, and, you know, you look at what it costs to get a mortgage if you have a indoor production facility in the space, you know, cost of capital is still 16%. In any other industry, you'd be paying commercial mortgage rates of 8. So just finding the money, raising the money, that's a shared pain point in any economist operator. And then If that's not enough, you overlay agriculture, because we are cultivators first and foremost. You know, we've had our hands in the dirt from day one. Our roots go back a really long time, not to, you know, in terms of some of the people who work in my company, they were tapping power poles 20 years ago. So, you know, we know this space intimately. And, you know, just trying to scale in this industry with uncertainty, with a lack of capital, and unfortunately, California also has like the worst regulatory framework known to man, or except for Canada. So you combine those, it ain't easy. And if you're trying to hack out a living as a compliant, you know, legal market cannabis company in California, that's not an easy game to play. So lots of challenges.
Well, and one of the, you mentioned one of the biggest challenges for cannabis operators is the capital problem, you know, related to 280E and other types of banking, and on the federal level, banking reform is needed. Are you hopeful for any type of reform in the near term? I know the Safe Banking Act has kind of effectively made its way through a couple times, but still gets killed on the Senate floor. What is your hope as an operator in the next, say, you know, 3 to 5 years? Is banking on the table?
Hope is not a strategy, unfortunately. I could speculate, you know, everyone knows a guy who just heard it from the guy who knows exactly what's up. Candidly, I don't pontificate on those type of things any longer. I believe if I were to say something meaningful to your listeners, design a strategy that allows flexibility for if things change, but allow you to be successful in the current market environment. You know, the thing I hear so much about is people talk about, hey, when legalization comes, you know, we're putting 5 million square feet in California, because when interstate commerce, you know, to me, like that's a screech across the record. You know, it's like, who says you're going to be able to sell across state lines? I'm not quite sure Michigan wants California weed eroding their tax base, their job base, and all those other. So it's like, design for what you know, and just be nimble and not overly, I'd say, you know, solid that you can't tack if the rules of engagement change. But designed for today. And so I could speculate, but I'll leave that to people either more informed or less jaded than I am, because.
Well, I mean, look at even the 218 Farm Bill, right? You have federal legalization of hemp, federal legalization of CBD, and you still had holdout states that were stopping shipments that were passing through. So you're right. You know, even with federal legalization, there still could be, you know, possible problems on the horizon. I only have you for a couple more minutes. And so
I mean, just as an example to make my point on the other point, which is healthcare is legal, right? Health insurance is illegal, not illegal at the federal level. Can't say, you know, 60 years, you weren't able to sell insurance across state lines, and you can barely do it now. Some industries unfold at a local state-based regulatory level. It doesn't have to be illegal to prevent effective interstate commerce.
That's true. 100% true. And you hit the nail on the head with, you know, there are ways for states to stop this from happening individually, even if the federal government decides to push it through. I know back in 2019, you guys were kind of looking at different markets to possibly expand into, or at least I believe that that's what you guys had going on a couple of years ago, pre-pandemic. Are there any markets right now? I mean, obviously you guys are killing it here in California, but are there any markets outside of the Golden State that kind of interest you, you know, such as say New York, which I believe is your home state, or, you know, something like Massachusetts, where, if you could move it to become an MSO, which market would most interest you?
Generally speaking, as a company, we're not interested in being someone's first experience. We want to be their last. You know, once they try my product, I never want to lose them. And so I'd say compared to some of the MSOs or stuff like that, we've been maybe not felt as much of a rush to get to, you know, many, many states. Again, when you look at this as a 50-year race, you know, you may, your perspective might change, you know. So where else would we go? I'm interested in them all in due time, at the right time, when we can execute against putting joy in a jar at the highest quality level. And I still, you know, had I started in some other states, I mean, California's a big market. We're still 33% of the adult use market in the United States. We got lots of work to do. And given some of what the strategic dynamics are, you know, for California companies, we tend to have, we're given what the regulatory framework and what it has condemned some California operators to, you know, we have to stay focused on winning here before we take the California consumer, which is the most educated, most demanding in the world, before we start trying to impress people in Michigan or Massachusetts. That said, I would be, one thing I would be surprised at is if we're not in multiple states 5 years from now.
We would like to thank Adrian for his time and being on today's episode. Find out more about Candescent by visiting them online at www.candescent.com. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you here on the next episode of Conversations in Cannabis.